Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. So you may remember a couple of weeks ago, maybe even closer than that, we had Jim Roberts on the show, who was the Senior Vice President and Market Director for Water and Wastewater at H2M Architects and Engineers. And we had just started to dive into an article that he recently published looking at emerging contaminants in our water. And as I'm talking to Jim, I'm sitting here going, why is the clock running out? I really want to dive into this more. I think this is really pertinent information for a lot of people in Connecticut. So I asked Jim to come back on the show and really dive into this a little bit deeper. So good morning, Jim. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Melissa, good morning. I'm very flattered that you would have me on twice in so short a period of time.
But oh, you stop it.
It's important.
It is. That's the thing, is it is really important. And I think, you know, an overview is great. But I think sometimes if you don't especially put it at a time where people may overlook it or maybe they're busy, you know, I think when we can reiterate things to people multiple times, I think it's a good thing. So just recap really quick, kind of give a summary of what your article looked at.
So Melissa, there are a few things that I think are very, very sort of front of mind in drinking water right now. So emerging contaminants, which we talk about, are really compounds that come from chemicals that we use for things like Teflon, Scotch Guard, what have you. Really, really front of mind with regard to their regulation and all of the agencies that govern drinking water across the many states, including Connecticut, are really sort of pushing on those issues, right, to get those contaminants out of the water. They are really being regulated at levels that are, to the average person, microscopic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So. You know, 10 parts per trillion. What's a part per trillion, right?
Yes,
you figure that
tell
out.
Me. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. It's a drop, an eyedropper of content in several Olympic swimming pools, right? So it's that minor.
Interesting.
It's that little, but it's not that minor because it is important as it relates to public health because it's known to be a carcinogen. So they are really regulating those types of things. I think there were some places that we talk about and I talk about in the article. Manchester, for example, is being proactive, right? They're doing we're working with them on a study as to how they can manage those issues if and when they reach a problem concentration. So I think the big picture takeaway for your audience is that they should be aware and they should be educated consumers and asking questions of their water suppliers, the people that provide them water. And sort of making sure that their elected officials are paying attention to getting monies to the water suppliers to be able to work on them, because none of the systems that deal with these things are inexpensive. They're all rather pricey, and mm-hmm. and maintaining and operating them over time are problematic. Yeah.
So Jim, how, first of all, do the contaminants get into our drinking water, and how do we remove it?
Right. So that's a great question. So most of these are what we would call legacy contaminants. The examination of what is in the water of, you know, every supply is sort of done routinely. These contaminants basically are legacy items that come from old manufacturing plants that discharge them after they, you know, maybe they're making Teflon for your skid-free pans, and you know that water gets treated and or it gets contaminated and then gets discharged into the sewer, and it winds up in the reservoir, and next thing you know, its life cycle kind of brings it back around, and that's what makes it somewhat vexing, right? Is finding the source of these things. There are a lot of lawsuits around the nation where the chemical companies are being held accountable, and I think that's another thing that the public should be aware of is they should want to see that the people who are responsible ultimately are held accountable for those mm-hmm. things. And a lot of the water suppliers are doing that, which is a good thing. But it takes a lot of energy and effort and You know, we everybody knows how stressed resources are across every industry.
Right. Yeah. We're talking this morning to Jim Roberts, who's the Senior Vice President and Water Wastewater Marketing Director for H2M Architects and Engineers, and we're talking about contaminants in our water. So is the current water we are drinking right now, Jim, if you are living here in Connecticut, is it deemed safe? And how do you know if your water has been tainted?
You know what, Melissa? You're perfect. You asked the perfect. You teed up for me.
Thank you so much. Can you tell me I'm perfect all the time?
Yeah. it's great. So let me, again, just for your audience and to try and keep it really high level, there are roughly 2,400 what we call public water supply systems in Connecticut. And the Connecticut Department of Health does a great job of, you know, monitoring and overseeing that population. There are a lot of suppliers in the state that serve, I'm going to say, small populations. So a community water system is defined as 25 or over, right? So we're serving 25 people or over. So whether it, you know, 25 million or 25 is a big span. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of suppliers in Connecticut that serve, you know, 50 people, 100 people. You know, little community systems, you know, apartment complexes. So you know, I think the people who are in those types of environments really need to pay more attention than others. And there is a lot of information on the Connecticut Department of Health website. They issue an annual compliance report that, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there that's inside baseball, but a lot of it is pretty straightforward. And again, consumers need to be sort of educated, right? They need to be interested in what's going on because they're the ones that are drinking the water.
Right. Exactly. I mean, can you taste if you have tainted water? That probably sounds silly, but like we're so visual, like, oh, this looks like it's rare, but I don't know if you can see a carcinogen. Can you see it?
You cannot.
Okay.
You parts per trillion. You can't. And look, I mean, again, the overwhelming, I mean, really overwhelming majority. I think the number of places that have documented issues are very small. And I think the Department of Health is on top of it and they're working on it. So we don't want to. I think the public should be very confident in what the Department of Health does to make sure that the drinking water out of the tap is good. I drink water out of the tap all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'll do that before drinking bottled water any day of the week. And I'm not impugning bottled water companies, but the regulation and the scrutiny of drinking water coming out of the tap is one of the most highly regulated things going. So I really think that public confidence needs to be there, and that's part of the issue. I think that's part of the problem is you know, we read things or we hear things, and people get a little spooked by it.
Yeah.
That's not good. So there should be confidence in you know, the public water supply systems. That's very important, but you should be educated, and you know, I can't overemphasize that.
Jim Roberts, who's the Senior Vice President and Water Wastewater Market Director for H2M Architects and Engineers, recently wrote an article about emerging contaminants in drinking water. And Jim has been saying, listen, you should really trust what our public health department has been doing here in Connecticut. They've been really taking care of this, monitoring it, and they're on top of it, and you should have faith. But you were saying, Jim, that it's hard sometimes because when you look at what's going on nationally, you have other states, you know, everybody thinks Flint, Michigan. I got to be honest. That's when you hear about water,
yep,
that's all people think about. And even though that's kind of in the past, a little bit in the past, that's immediately where people go. And you're right. I think there's this cloud over water contamination because you hear about these really outstanding stories that impact major communities. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's what's happening here in Connecticut. That's what you're saying.
No doubt, Melissa. Well, and let me tell you this. So the bottled water companies do a much better job at marketing their product than the public water suppliers. And that's generally because the public water suppliers are busy doing millions of things. And the bottled water companies are really in the business of selling, right?
Sure.
You know, so you know, we go into a whole bunch of things, but if you do the arithmetic, you know, you spend $1.50 for a 16 ounces of water, and you can get that for fractions of pennies from your public water supplier. So, you know, people should be aware of that as well. You know, marketing is go back to selling Coca-Cola in the movie theaters in the 40s, right? You know, drink Coke.
Right.
And people let's go to Melissa, because you really kind of touched on a little bit. I think another big thing, and again, this is targeted towards your audience, lead service lines are big in the lead issues in water and in just in public health in general, a big issue nationally. The federal government has put out $20 billion, which sounds like an enormous amount of money, but when you look at the sort of breadth and scope of all the water supply systems, it's probably not a lot, but it's a start. So you know, for your listeners, do you know whether your service line coming into your house, and generally, almost always, the issue is not anything to do with the public supply, but it's the connection from the public supply to your house. So do you know if your service line is a lead service line?
I do not.
If you do, yeah.
I do not know that.
Do you know?
I don't.
Yeah.
I really don't know. Okay. I would not know that. And that's what I think you're getting at, is like, that's a simple question that you could ask your utility company.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the place to start. Maybe you have your local plumber that comes in to do, you know, routine maintenance or something, have them look at it. Really, really big push across all the states. I'll tell you, your Department of Health, the Connecticut Department of Health, wrote a 12-page letter to the EPA on the new regulation that came out at the beginning, I guess at the end of 2021. So the rules are complex, and they're trying to make them more stringent. Generally speaking, I think, if you have a lead service line, you probably would consider replacing it. And that puts you in a better place. Anything I'm going to say from 1961, if your home's from 1961 or earlier, the probability, and you haven't done any work, the probability is probably a little bit higher, because that was the, you know, sort of material of choice.
That was
back,
the norm.
Back in the day. And it was, you know, what, again, you know, we didn't understand all of the potential ramifications.
Sure.
But, that's a really big push. All of the community water supply systems are going to be, they're faced with creating an inventory. So to the point, so that you know, so that people know, and you know, all of them will be working on that. And I guess the last little morsel I'd throw out there is, if there are requirements where the water departments have to take routine testings and they identify homes that they believe or they know have lead service lines and they test them, well, those test results are supposed to be available to the building owners, to the residents and the property owners. So if somebody comes in to test your water for lead, you should make sure that you get a copy of that, those results, and understand what those results mean, right? Again, I love saying it, you know, an educated consumer, and I think everybody just takes so much of the drinking water world for granted that, we need to be smarter.
Yeah. No, and I think having conversations like this makes people more educated on the matter and really helps them to understand it better. Jim, is there a way that people can access your article if they want to learn more?
Melissa, it is on our website, which is at h2m.com. We'll put it up on the front page, so it's a little bit more noticeable, but. It was published in almost all of the, you know, the Hearst Journal newspapers online.
I'll put a link as well on our podcast right underneath your segment. I'll put it right there. If people want to learn more, they can read it, because I think it's really fascinating and he's got some really great details in there. Jim Roberts, thank you for giving me the extra time this morning and talking about this. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me, and thank you for putting it on your site. Absolutely. That's helpful.
Oh, it's not a problem at all. Absolutely. You too, my friend. Jim Roberts here on WICC.
I want them to sit in a room, look me in the eye, and tell me, have you done everything humanly possible to make sure that you are monitoring this content the second it hits your platform? And if you're not, then I'm going to hold you responsible. So prove to me that there's nothing else that can be done.
You're hearing a very angry Governor Hochul in the state of New York because of the aftermath of the Buffalo mass shooting. And she's got every right to be upset because I, too, was pretty shocked about this. After the Buffalo shooting happened, the alleged shooter actually live streamed all of his actions from pulling up the car and then firing those shots. And you can watch the entire thing. In fact, someone sent it to me. I opened it up yesterday morning and I realize what I'm watching, and I shut it down pretty quickly. But I thought to myself, this happened Saturday, it's Monday morning, and it's still available for people to watch in full. Who dropped the ball here? So, of course, talking about social media, their impacts on society, we always check in with Krista Carnes, who's our social media consultant here on the show. Krista, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. This is so upsetting. It's so wrong.
It's pretty bad. Here's the thing. We've seen, unfortunately, mass shooters, they will do these live streams. I've seen attacks, even if it's not a mass shooting. I've seen it where people will live stream something that they're about to do that's horrific. It's not uncommon. Okay, but I've never seen it last that long. I mean, I couldn't believe it was still active yesterday morning. Like, people could access that video, and millions already had. I mean, can you remember it being up for that long? Like, have you ever seen that?
Well, my understanding, and I, you know, we decided, you know, I think information is still going to keep coming out about the proliferation of all, of the social media aspect of this. I did. I have understood that there have been people that were recording the recording, right? So with their phones.
Okay. So that's how it's
and sharing it that way, right? So and that's, you know, just technology that allows you to do that. So I believe they got it to shut down, but at the source of where he posted. But by then it was already, you know, the genie's out of the bottle, right? Like, it's already out there and you can't stop it. And, you know, this is not news, right? So, and it's gruesome and it's voyeuristic and it's, he is an avowed racist by his own admission. So, it sounds like he also had been cultivating a community of people. He had been sharing, like, he didn't just wake up one morning and decide to do this, right?
Yeah,
it was a very
so
planned thing, so I'm sure.
Yep.
So, yeah, and he had probably his own networks. Like, you know, it may come, they may end up analyzing and sharing sort of like the depths of, you know, the groups that he was a member of, the social media feeds that he followed and received, you know, and shared on. People must have known about this. And they said he was under investigation for all kinds of things and, you know, or had been alerted of his, you know, really, really scary, behavior prior to this incident. And nobody seemed to really either take it seriously enough.
Yeah.
I think there could be an argument to be made that if a lot of that was conducted on social media, that the social media platforms, to Governor Hochul's point of view, you know, could have shut him down and given him less access.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something that is not unreasonable to ask of these people. But that takes coordination, right? We've talked about this a lot. Like, these are still private companies. They need users. They need advertising dollars, you know, spent to reach those users. And there is a real disinclination to really partner with, whether it's partner with law enforcement or partner with communities in order to, like, make those consequences of reporting someone or if you have a question. But at the flip side of that, I also don't think I want Facebook policing people. You know what
right.
I mean?
Like, there's a middle ground. But you know, it's interesting, though, Krista, because I've talked to other people before who have been banned for like a day or something because they used a word or they used an emoji that was like inappropriate. And I think that's the question is, again, it comes down to that algorithms, which you hear that word all the time and you think to yourself, oh, my gosh, does somebody make sense of this? You know, how do you not detect a guy, even if it didn't detect it at first? like a guy getting out of his car. Okay, that seems pretty normal. But once you see a body hit the ground, I mean, I was able to watch long enough that I watched three bodies hit the ground. That should have been enough for horrific. It was so quick and it happened so fast that I'm surprised that there was no algorithm that could have picked that up and been like, hey, we can't post this. Well, we can't continue streaming. You know, like that's the thing.
Because it was live streamed, right? Like, think about watching a football game. You know, how fast would something have to happen? I mean, you think about the millions and millions and millions of people watching, and like, when something is live streamed. So I don't know if that technology exists that you could flag something that fast in that format, right? Because it's just live. Like, nobody knows what it's coming. It doesn't have, you know, there's no words to trip anybody up. There's no, you know, string of words. Like, there's a lot of, you know, digital kind of, you know, algorithms require digital data. Video is not that, it's not the same kind of content, right? It's video. So, you know, I think they could try to hopefully, figure out where it went from there. But I don't think there's, I mean, again, this, I guess for me, the better question is if he had gotten, you know, given his social media usage, assuming that there was strong indications of a predilection to violence, to racist based, violent ideologies and things like that. Mm-hmm. If he had been shut down, I don't know that it would have potentially stopped him from committing this act, but it certainly wouldn't have given him an audience. And that's what, I mean, from what I read, it was a very rational statement, like, you know, manifesto or whatever you want to call it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he doesn't seem crazy. But there is a community of people out there that believes what he believes, and he found them, right? And so he was celebrating this to those people. He wanted to be some sort of anti-hero. You know what I mean? Like, he's
right.
Looking.
And I think you bring up a really good point, Krista, which is the idea of, you know, here's the only good side, I think, in this situation of social media being involved, which is that you could maybe be able to find the people who are connected and be able to stop future things from happening. Because what ended up happening, for anyone who didn't follow, was the alleged shooter actually live streamed the entire attack. And it stayed active in some regard on social media up until yesterday. Krista made a really good point saying it could have just been that other people recorded it and then they could repost it. So it may not have been the original video, which is probably the most likely scenario. But you brought up a great point, Krista, which is that, you know, in these situations, of course, you're going to be angry about the fact that this even happened, that it wasn't flagged, that it wasn't removed. However, there is a little bit of a silver lining, which is if you could figure out the people who thought this was great or were part of his network, the alleged shooter's network, then maybe they could be flagged and kind of pursued to make sure that they don't ensue that kind of violence. Is that what you're saying?
I hesitate to be too prescriptive. I don't want to be too prescriptive of it because I don't know what's possible and I don't know what's prudent. Like, what, you know what I mean? Like, there are rights that we have to protect. You know what I mean? Like, and I think there are some people who are very savvy that could get around any regulation, right? Like, if you use the word baseball instead of rifle, do you know what I mean? Like, you're not technically going to flag. I mean, there's always a way around it. I guess the point being is, what do we as a society want from these platforms? If these platforms can be made to be held responsible mm-hmm. for the proliferation of some of this ideology, and, you know, there are clear guidelines that, you know, that they can't allow. It's because it's this incident is a long-term symptom of a problem that started a long time, like sort of with the birth of all this. Like, you be careful what you create, you know? I mean, this is a wonderful place where everybody can share everything. You know, it has its limits. And we've talked about before, broadcast television has always had regulations, newspapers, like traditional, you know, media guidelines, which is what so many of our laws are based on, don't apply. right? Because technically Facebook's not a publisher, and cable news is not, you know, it's not monitored under the same rules as broadcast television. And so there's, you know, there's a lot that needs to be fixed to bring this all together. But if we can, if we start holding those social media platforms accountable for what gets out there and can show perhaps that there was a pattern that was ignored by their moderation systems, their, you know, had people reported this guy before and they didn't act on it? You know, was there other things that the platform could have done to help mitigate the possibility of this, right? Like you would never probably be fully responsible for the end result, right. But is there things that could have happened? And, you know, and I know, you know, there's, you know, you were talking about people who get shut down for a day here and there. And, you know, a lot of that is gotcha. Like we're in that gotcha mindset right now.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like somebody or somebody says something that makes me mad, so I get 10 of my friends to go report their post.
Yes.
Good, bad, ugly, whatever it is. That person, you know, it's easier probably for those platforms to just say, you were reported, you're shut down for a day, we're not telling you who reported you, this is the violation that you had. But it's the accumulation. Are they tracking if somebody gets, you know, a huge percentage of, like, are they out, you know, is it out of line if you have 15 violations in a week versus just one? Or, you know, like, I don't know what the aggregate of all that data is doing. And I don't know, I don't believe that we have anything in place to require them to act on it if they do, or require them to capture it. Because as a society, and I don't, Congress doesn't understand social media, really.
Because this happens a lot.
It's, you know, they are not experts in social media technology. This technology is, you know, always changing, always on the forefront. But if you're a good actor, if you're a good corporate citizen, you have to look at yourself and work with people, help them understand it, help them understand what's possible, and then perhaps we can bring regulation or bills or requirements, you know, that are feasible and make sense and are effective. And you have to measure that over time, which these companies understand. And that's where I feel a little irked, like all the time, is like they could be doing better. They're not being made to, so they aren't.
Yeah.
You know what
that
I mean?
Makes sense. Yeah,
and
exactly.
And they're by the company, and they have shareholders.
They know what they're doing.
That's their excuse.
It's true. It's true. Krista, you always have such incredible information.
Write your state reps, write your federal government, tell them that you want them to figure this out, because this may have been able to be stopped, and we have to know if it could have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Krista, if anybody ever wants to connect with you or follow your social media account, how do they find you?
Find me on at Krista Carnes 22 on Twitter, at Krista Carnes on Instagram, and then just Krista at KristaCarnes.com if you want to email me. Love to chat.
All right. Krista, always love chatting with you. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, Melissa. Have a good day.
Thank you.
She's
you
an hour part of Connecticut Today. Melissa in the Morning checks in with Lieutenant Governor Susan Bisewit. Now on WICC 600 AM. At 107.3 FM.
Lieutenant Governor, it's so good to connect with you. It's been a while. How are you?
Good morning. It's a beautiful day, and it's nice to be with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have you with us here. So either were you in Milford? Did I see you in Milford?
You did. So it's a great way to start your week Monday morning by going to Silver Sands Beach in Milford. And that's what I was doing, because the state of Connecticut is looking for 60 young people to be lifeguards at our state's beaches and swimming areas.
So let's talk about, this is the lifeguard shortage that we've been dealing with, as well as the rest of the country has been dealing with. Where does Connecticut stand right now? Like where would you say we're missing lifeguards, and how many do we usually have on average before we dealt with the shortage?
Right. So we need 100.
Okay.
And we have 40 young people already signed up, and we need lifeguards. For instance, in Westport, New Fairfield, Milford, and other areas around the state to work at our beautiful state parks and keep people safe. There are some requirements that you have to be able to swim and you have to be able to run. And there are some requirements for swimming, how far you need to swim, how fast you need to run. But here's the good news. You don't have to be a certified lifeguard already. There's 80 hours of training that comes at the beginning. So you will be trained. You will be paid between $16 and $18 an hour. And now's a great time for young people, either students who are finishing high school, you know, or they're finishing their schoolwork for this year, or college students that are going to be free over the summer. It's a really great time to help others, to learn leadership skills, and be at our beautiful beaches.
How long is the season, Lieutenant Governor? How long are kids expected to, or lifeguards expected to, do their jobs? Like, how long's the season?
So it basically runs from Memorial Day through Labor Day weekend. But depending on your school schedule, you can work it out.
I mean, I think that's a pretty sweet deal. I always, you know, I have to say, when I was growing up, I was a babysitter for a family who lived on one of the Fairfield beaches. And and I got to, you know, when you start walking the dog and you take the kids down to the beach, you start talking to the lifeguards. And I have so many people who I never got to, you know, I didn't know them personally, but they always said they thought they had the best job. They're like, this is the best summer job. It's just the best summer job. You know, of course, there's some risk to it, of course, because you may have to save a life. You know, that's part of the gig. But it's just a killer job. I just can't think of a better summer gig, if you asked me.
Well,
I don't know.
Also, when you consider that even though we've passed legislation to go to $15 an hour, if you're 16, 17, 18, you can be making $16 to $18 an hour.
It's pretty nice.
Depending on your experience. And it is such an opportunity. You get 80 hours of training. So basically, your first 2 weeks, you're learning how to be a lifeguard and how to keep people safe. You're with your peers. And you have the opportunity to do good work in a very beautiful environment. So I agree with you. I think it, you know, it is a great job. And I have to say, I was a little bit jealous listening to what a typical day is like from the lifeguards there.
Right? Sounds you're great. Like, wow, you know, I don't get outside enough. When you hear a lifeguard
exactly.
talk about their day, you're like, wow, I maybe get outside 20 minutes. Lieutenant
and
Governor.
All you have to do is step out onto one of our beaches and see what a great environment it is. So,
oh, no question. I'm curious, Lieutenant Governor, are we at risk of any places either having shortened hours or not even being able to open up at all because we don't have enough lifeguards, or are we at least dispersed enough to open every state park and
no,
beach?
No, I think we should be able to, and the whole point of sort of doing this campaign to let people know that these jobs are available early in the summer will ensure that we have enough young people. So we are working with our State Department of Education and our Department of Higher Education to get the message out to all of our high schools, our community colleges, our colleges and universities. And for anybody who's listening, either a parent or a student who may be interested, just go to the Department of Environmental Protection website to apply.
Okay, so I'm actually going to pull that up for people because I'm already getting one or two messages asking where can we apply. Now, how old do you have to be? That was another question I just got. How old do you have to be to...
So I think you can... I think it's 16.
Okay, 16.
And again, there are some physical requirements. But as long as you can swim and run, you should be good to go.
Okay. And if anybody is asking to find that application, again, the DEEP website is actually at portal.ct.gov/DEEP. That's the Connecticut's official state website. Again, portal.ct.gov/DEEP. So DEEP. Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. We're chatting this morning with the Lieutenant Governor, Susan Bicewicz. And I wanted to switch gears really quick, Lieutenant Governor, because I can't help but notice you have been at a lot of rallies lately for understandable reasons for women's rights and trying to protect many people who are impacted by the Roe v. Wade decision that is supposed to be coming either late June, early July. But since that leaked document just weeks ago, there have been a lot of rallies across Connecticut. I saw you were at one in Stamford, I believe another one in Guilford this past weekend. But I haven't been able to have you on the show to give like a statement or tell us sort of where you're coming from with everything. So I thought we would talk about it a little bit.
Well, thank you so much for that. And I have to say that that leaked Supreme Court opinion is really very, very troubling because it shows that almost 50 years of long established rights for women are in danger of being rolled back. And the Roe versus Wade decision, in essence, says that women and their doctors have the right to decide when and whether to have a family. And the problem is that we are in danger of losing that precious right. Now, people in Connecticut should know that we do have a Roe versus Wade law in our own state statutes. So women are protected in Connecticut. But what was extremely troubling about that leaked opinion is it also puts in jeopardy the right of gay marriage, the right to use contraceptions, are long established rights. So it's very scary. And over the weekend, I was at five different rallies in every part of the state, and hundreds of people came out to protest, younger people, older people, everyone in between, men, women. It's very, very troubling.
You know what I think is interesting with the abortion talks, and this is really not political. It's really more just, I'm going to go with logical is sort of the word I'm looking for. I don't know if people really understand abortion as much as it's portrayed. I think when people think abortion, I think the average person, if you were to ask them, they're going to say it's a young girl who decided to have intercourse at a younger age, wasn't married yet, and made a mistake and didn't use protection and now would just like to abort. And sure, that is certainly a version of abortion that does happen in America. But I want to say the one thing that I think has come out of this controversy and the potential of Roe v. Wade going away or what's going to happen to it is I think people are learning more scenarios of when you need to use abortion. You know, moms who find out that their child that they're carrying for 30 weeks has limited oxygen and is going to literally be born a stillborn. If you want to go through the rest of it, you know, there are a lot of different, what I'm saying?
Right. I think what you are pointing out is that abortion is health care. Often it's married women that have to get abortion care because there is a problem with their pregnancy. And many people also may not realize that now the vast majority of early abortions are done with medication only. Two pills, right? And the other thing that I think is important is that the draft Supreme Court opinion really targets poor women, indigenous women, people of color who may have limited access to health care. Can you imagine if you find yourself in a position of having to get an abortion in Texas where it is now banned by state law, and you don't have the resources to travel to another state, that creates a huge problem. And so Connecticut actually just passed a law, and the governor signed it into law a week ago, legislation to protect doctors and medical providers who give reproductive health care to women who may be coming from out of state. It protects those medical providers because Texas actually wants to go after medical providers that give care that is not legal in the state of Texas. And I think it's important for Connecticut people to know that we have taken extraordinary steps like enshrining Roe versus Wade into our state law, and this safe harbor legislation that was just passed to ensure that Connecticut will be a place where people can get care that may be illegal elsewhere.
I also am wondering, Lieutenant Governor, I appreciate your comments. I'm also wondering if you think, with the discussions of Roe v. Wade, if we're entering a time where we need to find compromise, though, as well. Because I do think there are extreme states, not here in Connecticut, but I wonder what you think about extreme states who feel like it's okay to make a decision up until basically the day a baby is born. You know, because at that point, you are talking about a human life. Like, I think it's very black or white right now. And I'm wondering if we've reached a point in U.S. history where we need to find a common ground, if we need to find some better parameters where you could see sort of both sides, like you and I were talking about, you know, that it's not all one size fits all with abortion. What do you think about that?
I think that's right. What you see now, and by the way, Roe versus Wade does take into consideration how far along the pregnancy is and whether the woman's health is in jeopardy. So what we have in states like Texas are states that are beginning to ban abortion procedures so early, you know, say before 12 weeks, before 16 weeks, before a woman may not even
know they're pregnant. Mm-hmm.
that they're pregnant. And so I do think we need to find common ground in this country because this is a very divisive issue. But I think what this draft opinion of the Supreme Court highlights is the very extremes that we have in our country. Now, several years ago when the Supreme Court decided the Obergefell gay marriage case, what was heartening about that case was it recognized people travel around a lot. It's not like 100 years ago when someone was born in a town and died in that same town and they really didn't leave. Mm-hmm. Well, now people are very mobile. And so the Supreme Court recognized several years ago that couples travel and that your marriage should be recognized no matter where you go. And what the Supreme Court is saying in its draft opinion is now states can decide. And so you can have states that will decide that they don't want to have recognize gay marriage anymore, or they don't want to recognize a longstanding reproductive right, or even the right to contraception, the right to interracial marriage, things that we think have been around for getting close to 60, 80 years. Mm-hmm. Those rights are in jeopardy now because the Supreme Court is signaling that they're just going to let states decide. And I think,
right, if they set that precedent.
That, mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And so to me, that is what is incredibly concerning. It's not just women's reproductive rights, but it's the right to marry who you choose and even the right to use contraception.
It could be it could be a trickle down effect. That's a really good point. Like, what kind of a precedent does it set if this were to be overturned? It's a really good point, and that doesn't really get discussed enough. I appreciate you saying it, Lieutenant Governor. I wish I could continue chatting with you. We have run out of time, but I thank you so much for taking
Thanks
the time
so
to come on.
Absolutely, and look forward to coming back again.
Yes, I do too. Thank you so much. That's our Lieutenant Governor here, Susan Bicelitz.
So the State Board of
WICC.
Education announced the Teacher of the Year,
And it was to our very own Chrissy McCabe, who is a kindergarten teacher at Columbus Elementary in Bridgeport. Good morning to you, Chrissy. Thank you for being here. Congratulations. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. What an amazing honor and some great news this morning. How did you feel when you learned you were Teacher of the Year?
Well, I was surprised just because there are so many dedicated professionals. You know, I mean, especially last year, so many of us could have easily been in my position. It just so happened that I had taken some time on a Saturday morning to do a mindful moment with some of my families. I created a garden outside, and Superintendent Testani was there. And he saw the families and how engaged they were with my quote-unquote mindful mission. And so he saw that, and it was a powerful moment. And so, yeah, it was something else. It was beautiful.
I mean, tell us a little bit about the mindful moment. Was that something that you created because of the pandemic?
So I've been teaching mindfulness and yoga for the past 15 years to
wow.
children. And yeah, I mean, I actually was a stay-at-home mom for a little bit, and I was tutoring, and I'm so dedicated to my own yoga practice, and I thought it would be fantastic to become certified as a children's yoga instructor. And I realized how important it was and what an effect it had on these students of mine when they were on the mats and they were regulating their emotions and learning how to take deep breaths. I realized, wow, this is something else. So I brought it into my classroom when I went back to teaching. And last year, it was even more powerful because it was challenging for everybody.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know, I could definitely teach some of these families because we were all going through so much, how to regulate emotions, how to just practice deep breathing, and the students just loved it. They asked me all the time if they can practice with me. I see them in the hallways. And so towards the end of last year, I thought to myself, how can I connect with these families? Even some of them I hadn't even met yet in person,
wow.
just, you know, over the screen.
Sure.
And so I invited them, and I was meeting children and family for the first time all year, I mean, in person. And it really was magical, because not only were we were connecting through our Teams platform throughout the day in our lessons, but we were also there was a connection there already established, but then being able to bring everybody together mm-hmm. Was really something else.
It's a really amazing opportunity. We're talking to Chrissy McCabe this morning, a kindergarten teacher at Columbus Elementary and also the Teacher of the Year here in Connecticut for 2022. That connection between education and yoga, I think, is something that those kids are going to remember forever. And the reason I say that, Chrissy, is because one of my favorite teachers of all time was my fifth grade teacher, Mr. Banner. I'll never forget him, at North Stratfield Elementary School in Fairfield. And the reason I loved him so much was because he was an excellent teacher. But on top of it, he was from England. He was originally from England. He came over to America, and he was a soccer player. And I played soccer. A lot of the girls in my class played soccer. And he would actually, during some of the lessons, have us push all the desks to the sides. And he created this space in the room where we, you know, the kids, we can all, like, use a soccer ball and learn about teamwork and success and how to get to that. And it was just such an amazing opportunity. I felt like even if you didn't play soccer, it was just this really cool connection of moving your body, but also connecting, just growing as a human and in growing as a person and defining who you are outside of just the education, like the books and everything you read. And I think it was one of the things that made him stand out to me. And you sound like one of those teachers. Have you had an instance where in all your years of teaching, you've had students come back and go, wow, you know, the way you did things stood out to me?
So, yeah, that I sure did. So a few years ago, I happened to be in my attic and I found a thank you card from one of my first students. His name was Jermaine Brookshire. And it was a thank you card from his mom. And this was back in New Haven in the early 2000s. And I connected with him, and he actually was just graduating from law school at the time.
Wow.
And he remembered me, and he says, you know, you instilled such a love of reading in me, and thank you so much. And we got to talking, and he was actually very into mindfulness as well. So that actually connected with what I wanted to do last year with my families. And Jermaine graciously donated some funds to help me with the garden. And he actually was there.
He
was there that morning, and I saw him for the first time. And I can't even tell you, I mean, this young man, and to think that it was so special that I really made a difference. And that's exactly what we do as teachers. You know, we truly transform these lives, whether it's kindergarten, high school, even at the university level. You know, when you are an educator, you have such power to transform lives and inspire. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's amazing. I mean, I truly love what I do. And, you know, I can have a child come into me in the morning with their head down, and I know I have the power to have them leave my room with their head up and their heart shining. And and that's where it lies. It truly does. But I do want to say I was not nominated as Connecticut Teacher of the Year of 2022. I was Bridgeport Teacher of the Year. So I don't
want to. Oh,
I was Bridgeport.
Well,
that's okay.
If,
I don't.
If
yes,
it were up to me, I'd make you Teacher of the Year in Connecticut, because I think you're. I think it's very impressive.
Thank you.
I appreciate it, Chrissy. So glad to be talking this morning to Chrissy McCabe. She's a kindergarten teacher at Columbus Elementary School in Bridgeport, and she was just named the Teacher of the Year in Bridgeport for the 2022 academic year, which is really exciting. So, Chrissy, here's my last question for you. So with the pandemic, as you had mentioned, you know, teachers really stepped up. They had to step up, and they had to make do with a situation that most, if not all, had never really experienced before. And we're still kind of dealing with the fallout of mental health for kids and things like that. How did you turn such a dire situation into an opportunity? Because you sound like someone who just, you're like that classic line of like, you know, you're the sunshine on a cloudy day. So how did you take something? Well, it's just very apparent very quickly in talking to you. And I could see why you were given this award. But like, how do you turn something so rough into an opportunity to do something different or to still motivate your kids, motivate yourself even?
Sure. Thank you. So I just want to thank my father. I think he has a lot to do with this, and my mother, because he came over here from Greece with a penny in his pocket, and his work ethic, his drive has really, really inspired me so much. And my mother was also such a creative cat too, and so she inspired me to just think outside of the box. So being raised in such a wonderful family with a mom and dad who inspired me, obviously, was my that's where I started. But also it's mindset, and it really is when you wake up in the morning, your thoughts become your words become your actions. And we have such power as teachers to change these lives. So there were some days, but you know, I'm not going to say that there were days that were challenging.
Yeah, it's like everything.
There certainly were.
Sure.
But again, it was a hurdle, and sometimes it's okay to allow yourself to feel. And that's what I teach my students. It's okay to feel upset, you know, explore that, you know, and ask why. And I think it's so important for our students, especially now, and families. I think everybody, it's important to explore those questions. And I'm so lucky to be part of Columbus, because we have such a supportive family there, work family. You know, I have work moms and work aunties, and we really are such amazing role models for our students, because they see the connections and the love and the support we give one another.
That's beautiful.
So, yeah. Thank you.
That's amazing. And Bridgeport's definitely blessed to have you. Let me tell you, Bridgeport's very blessed to have you. Chrissy, how long have you been teaching?
15 years.
Wow.
15.
Wow.
Yeah,
and you've been in the Bridgeport. It sounds like you were in Bridgeport for the majority of it, but you've taught in other districts as well?
Yes, I have. Yeah, so I started off in New Haven, but then I went to private school. I was Eagle Hill, Southport. Now it's a Southport school. And there I was able to really hone in on some of my teaching practices, because it was all abilities, and I was able to teach multiple levels as well.
Oh, wow.
It was really a great experience there. And I'm in Bridgeport now, and I'm not going anywhere.
I love that.
I love teaching in Bridgeport. It's the best.
Oh, Chrissy, that's amazing. And like I said, Bridgeport loves you. We love you here at WICC. And we congratulate you again. Teacher of the Year in Bridgeport, Chrissy McCabe here on WICC. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much, Melissa. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.